You have come here on the recommendation of someone who says that you have had various special experiences in the area of psychic powers. And my understanding is that your husband is the author of a book called The Psychic Sense, published by Dutton. Is that incidentally right?
Well, we're both the authors of that book. It is the first piece of work we tried to do together, mm-hmm. to bring together my own psychiatric, psychological knowledge, which had led me towards a sense that many people had psychic experience, and that it was no earthly use trying to explain that simply as in terms of their own inner psychology. That is to say, if they see something which is outside themselves, see a vision, have a dream, something of that sort, that it's no use trying to interpret that purely in terms of symbols of their own unconscious mind. Mm-hmm. And we got together, and that was our first attempt at putting this, what we call colloquially, the psychic and the psychological material together, and seeing how the two coincided.
Well, may I ask, Dr. Bendit, how long after you met your wife-to-be was it before you found out that she was psychic?
Well, I knew 12 years before, because I'd known her for 12 years before we were married.
I see.
And we used to work in a medical group, which was studying medical problems, and I realized very early on that she was unusual for her type. First, in sometimes saying, I don't know. The second, in having a sense of humor. And thirdly, in being willing to investigate and look things up when required instead of getting impatient.
Even so, weren't you just the least little bit afraid of her?
Not in the least. Why should I be?
Well, most people, I think, have a somewhat odd feeling as they approach the area of the psychic. Of course, I suppose this, you would say, is mere superstition.
Oh, yes, I think it is mere superstition, but there was nothing frightening about this, and I'd known a number of people who had a certain amount of psychic capacity, and when I was a young man, I used to think, oh, no, I mustn't think about this, and I mustn't think about that. Mm-hmm. But I realized it was quite silly.
Well, Mrs. Bendit, I realize that it's difficult to discuss this kind of special experience, and particularly, I gather that it's rather difficult to discuss because I believe you told me before this broadcast began that you have always had this power.
Yes, I was born with it, just as any other child is born with a marked degree of capacity for music or mathematics.
Well, may I ask if this is at all hereditary in your family?
Yes, but it misses out whole generations. I am the only member of the family in either my father or mother's side that have it just now.
Now, I wonder at what age you first discovered that you were so different. Did you have brothers and sisters?
No, I was an only child, a very isolated one, and had very little ordinary childish experience. I had no idea until I was 19 that other people did not observe and see things in exactly the same way that I did.
You mean even in talking to your parents, you were
I
not
didn't
aware.
Talk to my parents. I asked my mother many years later, what about my early childhood? And she said, we must have been blind and deaf and dumb because we thought you were very highly imaginative, but we didn't think anything more about it.
Well, now would you tell us how you did finally make the discovery of your unique possession?
Well, it happened to be that I was in church one day, and I saw three ordinary-looking people, just as ordinary as those in the pews around me, but they were not on floor level. They were halfway between the floor and the gallery above. And in some kind of blinding flash of illumination, I realized that the people around me were not observing those three people. And I was terrified for a moment. I clutched the pew in front of me. I shut my eyes. I rubbed my eyes. I had 5 minutes blinding panic. And then I knew that I was observing them and no one else.
And did you decide that there was any special significance in their appearance?
No, I didn't, because they were so natural and ordinary to me. What I did think for the first time in my life was that I was probably going mental, or was the mental case anyway. And that frightened me very much.
Well, now, what kind of assurance could you have that it was not merely something that you imagined?
Well, life is strange. About 3 weeks later, when I carried that burden along in my mind and hadn't spoken of it to anyone, I went to a party. And at the end, a woman looked at me and said, "I'm going to give you my name and address if you ever want to come and see me." I thought that was very strange. But a little later, I went to see her. And the first thing she said to me was, "You've had a very bad shock, haven't you?" And I said, "Yes, I have." And she said, "You're very clairvoyant, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. That is what I want to find out." And she was the daughter of a Swedenborgian student. She was clairvoyant herself. She was a very fine psychic, much older than myself. And she did a great deal for me at that point in explaining things.
Well, maybe I should address this question to your husband. I was just wondering, and perhaps you too, Mrs. Bennett, have some opinions or impressions about it. How widespread do you think the possession of psychic powers is? Is it possible to make any guess?
Oh, yes. I think it's a very wide subject. But, you see, if you go back even to so orthodox a person as Sigmund Freud, I think that one comes to the conclusion that probably everybody has extrasensory perceptivity. When I say everybody has it, I don't mean that it's necessarily active or conscious, because it isn't in most cases. But a man like J.B. Rhine of Duke University, North Carolina, has done a vast amount of work, and his temporary conclusion is that, say, 50% of the students in the university are capable of doing experiments in extrasensory perception, and I think that's a very conservative amount.
Well, now, as I understand it, Dr. Bennett, you and your wife are speaking in this country under the auspices of the Theosophical Society. Now, am I correct in saying that the Theosophical Society offers certain opportunities to develop such powers, or does it have any connection?
Very definitely not to develop them. The Theosophical Society exists to try and encourage people to seek, to investigate, and very definitely not to develop psychism, but to develop understanding of life and the spiritual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And don't forget that the spiritual and the psychic are two quite different things, though people usually muddle them together. In the course of spiritual development, self-realization, whatever it may be, you have to understand yourself. And in understanding yourself, you will understand not only physical perception, but also you're bound sooner or later to understand your own extrasensory capacities, your psychic perceptivity, and as you understand and as you become aware of yourself, so those capacities tend to develop in a natural and healthy way. All other methods, all these sittings for development, yoga methods and so on, are apt to be extremely dangerous to the individual who tries them.
Now, what is the principal reason why they are dangerous?
Because they're trying to force something, force the development of a capacity in themselves which they're not ready for. And they're not doing it under proper control of their own conscious minds. Whereas in all psychological work, and I think in all true spiritual work, you are essentially trying to become more conscious and to bring things more under the control of your mind and your will, and not to dissociate yourself, to go off into trances and do things like that, which, well, may lead to insanity or very serious breakdowns in people.
But under certain circumstances, you would certainly recommend that these special powers be developed, say, mediumistic powers. You're not opposed to them, I take it.
Yes, I am opposed myself to the development of mediumistic powers by sending for development, because it's putting the clock back in time. It's diminishing one's hold on physical consciousness and awareness instead of increasing it. Now, exactly the reverse takes place if you work on the, we'll call it the psychological line, because there you are increasing your awareness and your control the whole time. And therefore, you're bringing everything under conscious control, and that is the essential thing, and is one of the essential steps towards spiritual development and self-realization.
I think it's awfully important that clairvoyance doesn't run away with you, but that you have it completely under your own direction and control, so that it's just like turning off a tap or turning it on when you wish to use it. Personally, I think it's dreadful to never be sure of what you're going to see next.
And if I understand you correctly, you found that you can turn this power off.
Always. I've always been able to turn it off or to turn it on. It is a power of the human mind, and it's just a matter of using it when it's required.
Does it take a tremendous effort of will to turn it off?
No, it's perfectly natural as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'd like to ask you a little more about your psychic abilities, with all due respect to the fact that I'm sure they're very difficult to describe, at least to anyone who's not used either to the phraseology or to the experiences. First of all, I wonder if you would give us some notion of what it is like to have such special experiences. I mean, I'm sure that these experiences come to you in different ways. I would assume they might come by, for example, some kind of image, or perhaps in other ways. Could you explain that?
Well, I'll try. It's very difficult. Here in the physical world, we look at all the objects that we want to do objectively. That is, they are outside ourselves, and we can judge them and we can estimate them. Now, from a clairvoyant point of view, as far as I'm concerned, exactly the same thing happens. They are objects to me in precisely the same natural way that a chair or a table is an object.
Now, may I, just for clarification, ask a question at this point? Underlying what you say, is there an assumption that there is another world more or less interoperating or interacting with our own, and that what you are seeing is simply that other world?
Exactly. That's always been so to me. I've always had a dual consciousness and a dual world.
And you have a fairly distinct impression of what that other world is like?
Just as naturally as one breathes the air of this, or has different kinds of experience, or observes different phenomena. It is, to me, just as normal, just as natural, and just as ordinary.
But its characteristics are rather different, aren't they? Because whereas the physical world has a stability and a consistency of shape of objects and size of objects, so in this other world, it's more a field of energies, moving patterns, isn't it, more?
Very often it's moving patterns, and they are very vivid in colouring, and they move very quickly, and they're very plastic. For instance, human thought makes shapes, but only very temporary shapes, just like an aeroplane making a trail in the sky. It's very much the same kind of thing.
And I'm sure that many unsympathetic people would say that this is actually a form of fantasy or dreaming, wouldn't they?
Entirely. And why shouldn't they? It's only when you can pin it down to a scientific form of approach and give it a groundwork that can be judged and gauged and checked by other means that you can hope to make it anything that is in any way reliable.
And it was precisely this that you decided to do in regard to your own power, wasn't it?
Exactly. When I discovered that I had this capacity and other people hadn't, I was absolutely determined to make it of use and to make it something that could be, at any rate, a reasonable proposition to be used in a working everyday life. And because my interests were along a medical line, and because all my temperament and my sympathy and certain amount of training Somewhere, perhaps, I don't know, if one brings in certain capacities that are latent, possibly we do. Anyway, I had a medical background behind me, and I thought that that would be the field, and so I refused to do any other kind of work. And for 30 years, I have done diagnostic work alongside my psychological work and taken only the problem case.
Were you doing this sort of thing before you were married?
Yes. Oh, yes, quite a long while. I had my own profession, my own work, my own secretary, my own car, everything in the ordinary way, just as every professional person does.
And since that time, you and your husband have worked together. Do you share offices or something like
that? Yes, now, and have done since we were married. But before, we had separate.
It doesn't mean that we always have the same patients by any means, but we very often work together. And you see, if I'm in a difficulty, I'll very often ask my wife to come in and, sometimes maybe a fairly simple thing, like has so-and-so broken a rib or not. And personally, I'm rather more satisfied with that than I should be with an X-ray examination in many cases, but I'm not a fool. And so if the patient has the slightest desire, in fact, I like myself very often to get the X-ray done because then I'm safe.
And so do I like to get it done because I like to know that I'm probably accurate.
Well, why don't you tell us now what happens to a person who comes into your office with some kind of difficulty? How do you handle it?
Well, let's start at the beginning. First of all, I only take work that is sent to me by reputable people, mostly medical people, men and women, and nursing homes and matrons and perhaps nurses who know of me and so on.
Now, they send only cases that are quite difficult to diagnose?
They send their throwouts that they can't cope with in the ordinary way. And that is my specialized field. And then the patient comes. I don't know them from Adam very often. I take their name and address and their age and usually their birth date. I do not ask them questions, but I sit and talk to them, perhaps rather casually. And then while I'm doing that, I'm making my observation. And if it's a case of referring back to the specialist or the doctor, I perhaps say a little about the case to them, often very little. And then when they've gone, I write the case sheet in an ordinary medical way and refer it back with my ideas on the case, any possible methods of treatment or obvious ways of approaching the trouble, or perhaps, as it is my speciality to have to crack the hard nut of the problem, I may possibly suggest that some unorthodox line of treatment or procedure should be carried out. And I should like to say that in the world of psychology, I do myself treat a great many of the cases that come my way who are the casualties of very bad psychic development or many of the psychic stupidities that can take place when people are encouraged to develop and they haven't the stability that they should have and they get into serious physiological and psychological trouble. And then I treat those myself.
You ask merely for the name and certain other basic items of information, such as the date of birth. Now, if someone wanted to be really cynical, might he ask you why, if you really possess this power, it's even necessary to ask those questions? Why couldn't the person just come in and let you go on from there?
Well, I suppose that is so, but it isn't normal in the professional world in which I live. That's the only thing.
I think also, wouldn't you agree, that a certain exchange does help facilitate your...
Well, I think to make a rapprochement.
You make a contact, yes.
Otherwise, you have no psychic field in which to make your discovery.
Now, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what it is that you perceive or how you perceive. In some cases, you actually, I believe you mentioned earlier, when we were talking before this program, in some cases you actually possess a kind of X-ray power, for example.
Yes, that's true. So that one can count how many stones there are in a kidney or in a gallbladder, or can say where an ulcer is, where its position is, how big it is, how severe it is, and so on. You can count the layers of the muscles of some of the big organs and tell a specialist which layer of the muscular organ is deteriorated, count the heartbeats, watch the bloodstream, and so on.
It sounds even better than X-ray.
It's much better because it's alive. An X-ray, after all, is only a shadow.
Yes.
It's a three-dimensional instead of a four-dimensional.
And X-ray can be very inaccurate, of course, as you know.
I might perhaps just butt in here by saying that also, you see, that it is not a telepathic thing. It is an X-ray thing, or being able to see through things, because on occasions, my wife has been able to say, for instance, which plug on my car was not firing, or where the trouble lay in my car. Well, of course, a car has no mind, so obviously it was a matter of really seeing through the thing, and it's very often short-circuited a repair quite a lot.
Yes, that is perfectly true. And I'm just at this moment thinking of a doctor colleague of mine who sent me a patient because she had some kind of colon trouble that couldn't be recognized and couldn't be found or discovered. And I realized that she had a very peculiar kind of bug that I had never seen in my experience before, and I just didn't know what it was. So I sent back the report to say that she had got this infection, but I hadn't the least idea what it was. I had a feeling that it might have been gathered up while she was out in the East, but even so, I'd no idea of what it was. And so he got that analyzed by the Tropical Diseases Hospital. And that was so entirely. It was a very rare bug, which is very well known in India, but very seldom caught by people. But I didn't know what it was. I just knew that it looked completely different.
So it's a rather sharp visual image that you have.
It's a very sharp visual image, much sharper than physical image.
Well, a sort of third-dimensional thing?
Yes.
Now, in what other ways do you discover what's wrong with the patient?
Psychologically, by watching, observing, studying the auric field which surrounds every human being. You possibly want to know what that is.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it is the only thing that we can give a correspondence, and then it's not a perfectly true one, is that it's analogous to an electromagnetic field. It is a field of energies which has color and a certain rough shape around every individual. It stretches about 3 feet on every side, on each side of the individual, and it's in constant movement. It's always altering and reshaping itself, following the impulses of the thought and the feeling of the individual. And through the years, I've used that as a diagnostic chart, just as a doctor looks at a clinical chart.
And any time you wish, you can suddenly see this particular field come into view.
I can click on in my mind, as it were. It's just a slight action of the will producing another angle of my mind, that's all.
Mm-hmm. And how did you know how to interpret what you saw, even if you saw it?
By trial and error, by working hard, by studying psychology, studying people, by making mistakes, by going over the same ground 50 or 60 times. I've got a kind of scientific mind, and I love making experiments.
And don't forget your reference to Gray's Anatomy.
Oh, yes. Now, that's another thing. I learned, this will amuse you probably. I learned, really and truly, learned my anatomy by looking within the individual And, of course, the ordinary things that I learned at school I knew perfectly well, but a great deal else I didn't know at all. And then I would go to Gray's Anatomy and get the illustration and get the whole setup of the thing, and particularly how to spell it.
So, now, am I correct that these are the two ways in which you...
There is a third way, which I have done a certain amount of test work in scientific investigation, in which we call technically magnification. That is, you take a particle of matter that perhaps will only just balance on the point of a needle, and by a special mental action in the mind, enlarge that to any size that you want, and then you can observe it, as it were, from inside, so that you can count, find the proton and count how many electrons there are in that particular atom of material, and then change it to another atom of material and again find your proton and count the difference of electrons and watch their dance and their interweaving, just as the scientist will explain it to you.
I think I can give you an example of the kind of thing, because we were talking one day, actually in a crowded room, with a distinguished scientist who's produced a lot of penicillin. We're talking about penicillin. And my wife said, I should like to see the stuff. It was in the early days, and he produced a sealed glass tube with some yellow powder in it and handed it over to her. And after a minute or two, my wife said, but it has...
Seven
different patterns in it.
And he jumped out of his skin nearly and said, but that is true. How do you know? So I said, I may have caught that from your mind. But he said, anyway, tell me about these seven patterns. So I told him the difference of the seven patterns. That might have been straight telepathy. He was there.
Well, now I'd like to ask at least one more question about this human aura. You mentioned color. Now, what is the significance of color?
Well, you know, we intuitively talk about that in everyday life. You will say, so-and-so is green with envy. Mm-hmm. Somebody else is gray with fatigue. Somebody else has a fit of the blues. Now, they are just expressions of an intuitive thing that we all sense in ordinary everyday life. And they are perfectly true. It does follow that if a person is frightfully depressed, the whole of the auric field blots out into a kind of grayish-blue fog, which is very depressive in colour and is extremely indicative of the mood.
But having the blues is a real thing.
Yes, quite. Or if you're angry and you say, I saw red about a thing, well, you actually do see red, because you are looking through your own auric field, and for the moment, while you're feeling the anger, it is diffused right through with scarlet, with red.
I think a word of caution there, that these colours, of course, would be very different from the ordinary physical colours. One is translating into... You see, all these things have to be translated into terms of this material, three-dimensional world of ours. Mm-hmm. And consequently, it's rather like projecting a three-dimensional object onto a two-dimensional screen. Mm. I think that's worth mentioning at this point.
Now, can you, for example, tell whether a person is good or evil by this?
Well, that's the thing I don't like being off, because I don't like sitting in judgment on people. But naturally, just as all you yourself or anyone else has that feeling of repulsion or attraction to a person, which is instinctive in your case, you are merely reacting to something that is reaching you. Well, to me, it happens to be a visual thing, and one is aware in colour and shape and particularly quality of the auric field, whether people are not very nice people or whether they're very good people.
Now, what do you mean by quality? I'm sure that's very difficult to explain, but...
Well, perhaps you could explain to me the qualities of light, because it's very much the same sort of thing. If you're a technician in light, you are accustomed to the thought of
quality and texture in light, aren't you? Well, it's precisely the same thing.
I see. Now, about these changing shapes, is there a distinct kind of pattern that they follow?
Yes, and in psychological field, these patterns run into certain, roughly speaking, grades of behavior. For instance, if a person is out of contact with life, if they can't make relationships, if they are isolated and truly shut in and lonely people, which we all know somebody who's like that. Now, the edge of the auric field retreats from expansion and it curls in on itself at the edge, precisely like a leaf will curl and twist in the autumn wind until it's a rolled up edge. Now, that person is really out of contact with life because he has very little outgoing from his auric field and he refuses to take anything in. And in that process, he's curled back the edge and made it a kind of self-protected area.
Should we say that that person lives in a shell? And according to this, literally, they are living in a shell.
It even assumes almost the appearance of one.
Exactly, yes.
Well, now, Dr. Bendit, you have often worked with your wife in these cases. Have you ever known her to make a real mistake?
No. I've got to be honest about that. If she has made a positive statement about something, I have never yet found her wrong. I'm always looking out for it, not in any malice, but we might almost say in self-protection. But I will go so far as this, that sometimes when somebody has we've been tackling one aspect of a person, say the psychological aspect, and she has confirmed perhaps my own diagnosis, somebody who's schizophrenic, by saying that person's aura was completely split over the head, literally schizophrenia, split mind.
Amazing.
Well, then perhaps, of course, she hasn't looked to see whether their liver was functioning properly or something like that. But that is not exactly omission. It's certainly not making an error. It is just emphasizing one side and not focusing on the other.
Oh, I should like to say that one is, of course, open to error, just as in any other department of life. And as we make so many mistakes at the physical plane, well, it's only inevitable and natural that one should make mistakes on the psychic side. But there is just this about it. If you really have a definitely trained degree of clairvoyance, and if you are making a very careful observation, you are not very likely to make a major mistake, but you are likely to leave out details.
Yes, I'd agree with that entirely.
Now, if I understand correctly what has been said, there are, however, a certain number of cases which you do not attempt to deal with for one reason or another. You do exclude certain cases.
Yes, I do. I exclude all kinds of cases where people want the future told for them or where they want to get out of their difficulties without paying their own price, which everybody, in my estimation, should do. And I will not be spoofed by people. Quite a lot of people have tried that on, but touch wood, so far I have not yet been caught out.
You mean you can actually tell in advance whether somebody is liable to pay his fees or not?
Indeed, no. I am.
Well, it's not a matter of fees. It's a matter of paying the psychological price, which is sometimes the awful thing of seeing oneself as one is.
You might be interested here in the story of one of my very best friends now. She came to see me. And she said that she had come about her hay fever. And I looked at her and I said, you haven't come about your hay fever nor anything whatsoever to do with your health. And she laughed and she said, no, that's true, I haven't. So I said, well, please tell me why you came. So she said, well, I read your own book and I was determined to get to know you and to meet you. And so I made up an excuse, and it isn't true, and you are completely right.
Has anybody ever disagreed with you when you indicated that you thought their motives were not what they pretended to be?
No, because they've been so startled by the fact that I just saw through them that they usually made either a friendly contact with me or else they'd just gone away at once or I sent them away.
Well, has anyone ever accused you of making a false diagnosis?
No, I've never been accused of that, and again, I'm a touch wood.
That is a remarkable record, isn't it?
Well, I think so, but then, after all, if you send a blood film to a skilled pathologist, you don't expect him to make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're as skilled as my wife has become in the course of years, well, again, why should she make mistakes?
You see, there is just one thing. I have always tried to be as honest as I possibly could. And if I can't do a thing, I say so at once. Mm-hmm. If I don't know a thing, I say so. And if I can't manage the case, I say at once, I am sorry. This is something I cannot do.
That doesn't mean to say that sometimes you're not puzzled over a case because it's so complicated and the whole thing doesn't become apparent at once.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps never does become apparent. But that's quite another matter. I mean, everybody has cases they know a certain amount about and then they fumble, if you like, as to the diagnosis. But I think another thing one should say there, which is that to be able to make a diagnosis is not necessarily to be able to suggest treatment. And it's one of the things I keep on when I'm in the thing to say, well, yes, you can certainly see my wife, but how is that going to help you? You are a psychological case. You've got to do the psychological work and find yourself. And if she tells you that it's this and that and the other thing, it doesn't it's not going to help you to short-circuit your work. You've got to do the work and pay the price, not necessarily in money, but at any rate in energy.
And I take it that this other work or prescription beyond the diagnosis is pretty much your field.
Well, if it happens to be my case, yes. But it's not always my case at all. It may come from somebody else and have to be referred back to somebody else. It may come within my field or it may not. I mean, if my wife says, I've got somebody who's got a pain in the stomach region, and I get my wife in and she says, well, there's trouble in the back between such and such vertebrae, and that person should go to an osteopath. Well, obviously, the osteopath is a person to deal with that, not me.
Mm-hmm.
We don't boost each other up in the profession, if that's what you mean.
Oh, no.
We're not out for that.
In fact, in the majority of cases, you work on separate cases?
Yes.
Unless we want the help of one another. I mean, my wife calls me in sometimes if the person wants a medical overhaul, an ordinary thing, blood pressure taken, or sometimes take on psychological treatment. And I call her in if I get a case which I think would benefit by either her examination on the physical condition, or sometimes a certain amount of common sense talked about the jam they've got into through automatic writing or sitting for development or some psychic matter, or they're being, shall we say, psychic and not quite understanding it. And then back comes the patient to me.
Each have our own practice. That's what it amounts to.
Well, Mrs. Bendit, are you absolutely determined then in regard to the future that you are not going to use your powers in any other direction?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think I'm going to stop working altogether. No, I should never be happy not working, but I do want to do a great deal of research work, and I would like to now drop professional work and turn over to the research side. There's so much that has to be done, and so few people of my kind who are willing to cooperate and who have the patience to make the same experiment many, many times, which is the scientific method of doing it.
And you see, I think you have to realize also that certain forms of research, I mean, take this question of magnification and all that kind of thing, requires a very fine degree of focus and a lot of energy. And to have that, have the telephone bell go in the middle of a thing like that can be an awful shock and certainly a strain. And consequently, one has to try and find peaceful conditions in which to work.
In other words, the research you have in mind is further investigation of the powers to which you have limited yourself.
Yes, I do feel that. At this age, I've done a great deal of professional work, and now my husband and I, we both write, we both lecture, but I would like to devote the rest of my working life to a good deal of different study and research work, yes.
Have you ever been attacked by somebody, Mrs. Bendit? Has your whole method come under serious attack, say, from professional men?
No, strangely enough.
What is the attitude of, let us say, the British Medical Society to this sort of activity?
The British Medical Association pays no attention to it. But, you see, since academic work has been done in parapsychology, no scientist, and I emphasize those words, who has studied the evidence can afford to say that this is all nonsense. They may query individual things, but if they're scientific, and not just prejudiced people who pretend to be scientists, materialists and all that sort of thing, if they are really scientists, they must admit that there is a possibility of these things and realize that this sort of work rests on its proof, mm-hmm. on the results.
Well, as a final question, Mrs. Bendit, I'd like to ask you, if anyone should hear this program who believes that he may have some stirrings of psychic powers, what kind of recommendation could you make to such a person?
Now, there you've asked the most difficult question of the whole interview, because from my point of view, and this is a theosophical point of view, every person is endowed with his own degree of psychic perception and capacity. He may know nothing about it, he may be quite unconscious of it, but it is there. And the trouble is, particularly with clairvoyance and psychometry and things of that kind, unless you are going to make a hit or miss, standard of work, honestly, I think it's not really worth bothering with. I think to live your own life the best you can and to leave these things alone is probably the wisest thing to do. If you have a very marked degree and it is under your own control, then there is a great deal that you can do with it. And first of all, I think you have to become aware in yourself of how the capacity works, where it works, and under what conditions. And that is the first field of observation that I would suggest that anybody makes. And then secondly, to check up on all their observations, to put it down with the time, the date, the observation, and accurately, and to put a very honest assessment of whether it has any validity or not. To be absolutely straight driving on this question of objectivity. It isn't a thing so many people talk so much, and when you come to investigate it, it's just like hot air, there's nothing there. But to have to get the thing into a workable shaping, you've got to be completely clear-minded, completely objective, and quite impersonal. That's asking a bit lot from some people.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. and Mrs. Bendit.